Hello, Bootstrapped Web. We are back. Jordan, how's it going, buddy?
Hello, Brian. Good to be back. We're keeping a cadence here every week, like a podcast should be. It's nice.
I feel much more relaxed than last Friday today.
After because the rabbit hole conversation. So
Yep.
What'd you do this week?
I was sort of all like wound up last week, but this week I just got back from a relaxing week in Martha's Vineyard. So it was nice.
That is nice. And that was personal? That was biz? What was that?
That was one of these tiny conf business retreats. So this one was organized by Ben Orenstein. So thank you, Ben, again for the invitation. And we were talking about these things really shouldn't be called conferences. Because, I mean, especially this one, this was like six people. A few people dropped out, and so it was kind of a smaller group.
It's a meeting.
It's a retreat. It's a mastermind group.
Yeah.
Most of us were returning, but there was, I think on this one, there was one new person who, you know, whenever you get a first-time attendee to any of these tiny comps, it's always just like, wait, so we're just hanging out and talking and doing fun stuff? Like, that's all this is? <You know?
laughs> Get settled in, bud.
Yep. Okay. So yeah, cool. It was a really, really good time, really good conversation. Good to hang out with a couple longtime friends in this thing. And I always love these tiny comps because it's like both relaxing and productive because it's like it forces me to step back and think about big picture and get some real good feedback on the big picture from folks. And it's fun at the same time. So yeah. I mean, the weather was unbelievable. It was absolutely perfect, like 70s, you know, not too hot, not a cloud in the sky. I mean, there was one day where we jumped off this dock into the ocean, and that was a great time, and just, you know, eating, you know, really great meals and hanging out in a nice Airbnb. Yeah, just perfect.
Just a couple of SaaS founders gallivanting around Martha's Vineyard. That sounds lovely, and that's one of the most beautiful places in the country. You got the weather for it. You got the whole deal. Nice, man. Well, I was dodging human feces in San Francisco, but okay. Same thing.
All right.
Yes, I just got back from San Francisco. I spent 2 days there. I went to the Stripe conference, Stripe Sessions, which is like their partner conference they do for 1 day. That company is just all class. Everything they do is done well and done nicely and in a friendly way. It's an inspiration. It continues to be.
One of the funny small conversations we had at the trip was, I think we were talking about Stripe and somebody heard something about them like hiring like another 100 developers or something. Now they have like a team of like, I don't know, 250, 350 developers on a team in the company. And we're just like, how is that even possible? Like, what do they all work on? You know, like how can you just throw so many engineering heads? I know it's a complicated product, but it's a single product company, basically, more or less.
Not anymore. It is varied. And one of the interesting things that Collison, the founder, talked about was their specific strategy of addressing the entire market, startups to enterprise. And usually that's the wrong thing to do. That's the perceived, the common wisdom is you can't satisfy both, so you have to pick one. Or what he was saying, what normally happens is you start off at the lower end and you make your way up market. That's like the natural life cycle of a lot of these software companies. And what he was saying was that they very specifically, deliberately don't. And so, yes, they're working with the largest enterprises in the world, but they keep a focus on startups at the same time because that's where all the innovation is coming from. That's the segment of the market that demands your software is good. Right. Enterprises don't actually demand that your software is good. Like you make a deal and then they implement the deal that was made from higher up and there's no choice about it. You just do what you're supposed to do. Startups, if you're no good, they're out. See ya. Go to your competitor.
People just jump around. Yeah.
So to do it and to do it with payments and at that scale is so impressive. But
yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine like the technical challenges that a company like Stripe needs to deal with. But still, I think about like the sheer number of people and seats in the company. It's like, all right, we need to work on some new feature. They could literally put two parallel teams of 10 engineers to work on the same feature and see which one comes out better. You know, that's just a random assumption that I make. Like, I just think of like all these like extra heads hanging around.
Yeah. My assumption is that they're really busy and they can't hire fast enough. And it's hard to find engineers that work, you know, for them in terms of talent and skill level. And at the same time, they still have a humble air. You know, I was talking to a few of my, I guess, friends, people who work at Stripe that I've gotten to know over the years from Carthook, and they're still very humble. It's not like this arrogant thing, like we're so awesome, we can do anything. When we talked about them going remote, they're worried. They're not sure if they know how to do it. And they're going to invest a lot in making it work, but they're definitely not 100% confident in being able to make the remote transition, especially around engineering. They know it can be done, but up until now, they haven't done it. They've got this giant office in San Francisco. They have an office in, I believe, Ireland, maybe a few other places. It's a company that we idolize, and you talk to them and they're dealing with a lot of the same issues and questions and unknowns that we are.
The never-ending conversation of remote versus in-house teams and Carthook is interesting because you guys are sort of like a hybrid. So, you know, I've got this new part-time developer who is officially, he actually already kind of started, but we're officially starting next Monday. He's in South Africa. For me, I don't see any path to becoming an in-person office company.
You don't see how that can possibly be in your future. Is that what you mean?
No, like I definitely see the benefits of it. I'm just saying, like, the way that I'm currently working and hiring now, I don't see any point at which I could possibly make a switch to in-person, because I'm, for the last 10 years, I've been hiring remotely in this sort of a new company that I'm growing now. My first hire is on a different continent. Like, if I'm going to continue to hire, you know, even if it's a small team, like, I'm definitely going to hire remotely. There's not going to come a day, I just don't see logistically where there would be a day where it's like, okay, everyone, you either all need to move to this city or you're out. Like, that's not going to make any sense. So I think I'm just sort of forever on this path of remote. And I've always loved remote. So, but it's like, even if I wanted to go in-house, I feel like the only real way to make that pathway work would be if, like, you have a partner and you're both in the same city and you make your very first hires in that city and you have to live in a city with a good talent market. I'm not in that situation. And I've been bootstrapped, self-funded. So, you know, hiring remotely sort of makes more sense for that as well. I was just thinking about it because I know somebody who they've been remote and now they're growing to, they're around 15 people, and they were sort of actually considering making this transition to more of an in-house team. And then they ultimately decided the logistics are probably for various reasons, but the logistics just don't make sense. They're just going to continue growing remotely.
So I think 95% likelihood, you're right. And that's the far more likely thing to happen. I like to keep that 5% open and just give myself the room to think, if I want to, I can do whatever I want. Profitwell, I saw them at a conference in San Francisco. I stopped by the second day I was there. SaaStoc, they're all moving to Salt Lake City. It's a decision you make. You have more leeway than you think. And especially if your company is doing well, people will move. People will change their lives to stay with your company if they really like their work and they like their job and they like the opportunity. And it's early on. You don't know what 5 years from now looks like. So I just like to keep that 5%, say, I don't know, if that's what makes sense, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, who really knows? It's just, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, not to be annoying devil's advocate, but I moved to Portland and I opened an office here. I would have put 0% probability on that when I started the company.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
On the thing today, on the docket here, I've already talked a little bit about this tiny comp, so we can cross that off. I don't know how much of this we'll get to. I know that you and I wanted to maybe give a little reaction to Justin Jackson's and John's podcast. Talk about, they asked the question of when is enough MRR? When is it enough? And we can talk a bit about that. I have some thoughts on that. And then I've got some small things. Just, I expect that by the time this goes live, my new design on briancastle.com, my personal site, will be live. Anyway, I'll get into that. And then I'm doing a quick productize opening in September. So when you hear this, I think it'll be through this weekend. It'll be open and then closed on Sunday night. So this is like one of only about four openings that I've done this year. And I don't do them like evergreen or anything. Like, this is an actual opening happening only in September.
Real scarcity online?
Yeah, I know. I mentioned it last week, probably going to move to MailChimp. I'm in the process of reworking my automations, and I'm actually doing sort of like a MailChimp plus Zapier for a lot of these automations. Yeah, so that's sort of interesting. And this developer is starting with me next week, so I'm still kicking around ideas for how to be productive with him.
Right. All right. Very nice. Well, I'm looking forward to that convo on the podcast episode from Justin and John on Build Your SaaS. SF Trip I talked about. I could talk a touch more on that and just like the importance of getting out of the office. And then I had an example pop up over the past few days. We've been focused on this development process, and I had this beautiful, perfect, shining example of how something goes just a little bit wrong, but the outcome is wrong, and what all of us can learn from it. Like I use that internally, so I can talk about that experience and what we're trying to learn from it. All right, so you want to be a bit derivative here and talk about someone else's podcast episode?
Let's do it. Well, I mean, cool. Why else do we have podcasts than just to talk about other podcasts?
Okay. John Buddha and Justin Jackson run a podcast called Build Your SaaS, where they talk about building Transistor.
Highly recommended.
Highly recommended. Fantastic podcast. So they recently hit 20K MRR, I think. But I think they're an open company. I'm not just like saying things that I shouldn't be saying.
I remember I don't know the numbers closely, but I remember like early on they were like, it's going to take us 5 years to hit 20K MRR, and I think they did it in like a year or something like
that. Yes. Yeah. So clearly that's working. And so I don't know if it was a listener question or just a tweet or something, but they got onto the topic of how much MRR is enough. And listening to that conversation, I had all types of feelings and reactions. So, or if you want to start off with what your thoughts are on, or if you want me to dive in or
yeah, what? You dive in. Yep.
Okay. So on the question of how much MRR is enough, the easy flippant answer is there's never enough, right? But that's not valuable. I think what they were trying to get at is we don't want to just look at infinity as our goal and $1 billion company or bust, right? That's not very healthy. And so they're looking at their situation and saying, how much do we actually need before we are kind of in a good situation and happy with our company and don't feel the need to just grow and grow and grow forever and faster and faster? And a lot of what they were saying matched exactly with my feelings at that same stage, at that 10 to 20K in MRR. And I had the benefit of having a really important conversation with Rob Walling. So I was out in MicroConf Europe, and I was listening to Rob give a talk about his experience with Drip. And he was talking about being at 120 or 130K in MRR and not being profitable. And from my perspective, I was somewhere around the 20K in MRR. I was scratching my head. So I said, Rob, I don't mean to be like a jerk about it, but how are you not profitable at 120K MRR? Like, help me understand why, what that looks like. And what he said to me stuck. What he said was, when you get there, you will be faced with a trade-off. You'll be able to be profitable, or you'll be able to grow faster. So that sounds like, oh, grow faster or be profitable. Like, I guess I can make that trade-off and see how I feel. But the other part of it is the reality of your customers and the support they need and the features they need and your team size, being able to handle a certain number of customers and being overloaded, then you start to have these responsibilities as the owner and manager of the company. And it's not just a trade-off between faster growth or profitability. It's really about profitability or making people unhappy, like your customers because they're not getting the features and the support that they need, and your employees because they're overburdened. It's too much stuff for the number of people that you had earlier on. That is what I thought was very understandably missing from the conversation between Justin and John, because they're looking at their current situation. Hey, we've got a few people. I think they might have, what, one or two employees? Just a few. So it's a small team.
No, Justin and John, I think they're just the two of them.
Oh, that's right. They're considering hiring their first one.
Right.
So everything feels so manageable. The thing is, it's like I heard exactly what my mindset was in that stage. And I felt the need to be like, guys, careful. Or at least give a heads up or use it as like a teachable moment, because I had the same mindset. But once you start hiring people, and the whole thing about their growth – is because they're onto something. So they're doing something that the market wants. And as you grow, it's not going to slow down. It's actually going to accelerate the demand. And then people are going to talk about it more. And there's going to be a larger customer base talking about it. People are going to be happy. It starts to compound on itself. It starts to run away from you, which is an awesome thing. But when it starts running away from you, it will no longer be this easy decision of, well, you know, how much is enough for us? And how many people do we want to hire? And how slow do we want to take it? It starts to take on a life of its own. And you are, you know, what's that saying? Having a tiger by its tail. It's right. The saying is good because that tiger can turn and bite you in the face. It's a dangerous proposition.
I haven't really been in the seat that you and Rob Walling have been at that level of MRR with a software product. My assumption would be that like once you reach that level, even if your product is fairly mature and you have like basically all the key features already built, first of all, there's always new features to build, but then there's a baseline just maintenance when you have that much volume, that customer base, like you have to not only support them, but maintain the code under them and continuously improve and refactor. And that takes people, you know, resources. So that adds to your cost, no matter what you want. But I think on that point though, I think that it sort of depends on the product, how simple it is and how, like, do you actually have to continuously build really big, complex new features, or is it kind of just enhancing the core value proposition? And every product is different, and there's no right or wrong answer to that. It's just,
absolutely,
you know.
My guess is that I'm speaking to the majority of situations is a great thing to not be in that situation. I know people personally here in Portland who have businesses twice the size of mine with a fraction of the staff, and they are not overburdened and not freaking out. So it is possible. I think Transistor is in a space that's going to just have a very loud user base. There are so many options coming on the market. So I think it's more likely that they end up in that quote normal use case of a company growing and a lot of demand and a lot of, there's just a lot of things you don't even think about. Like your support docs turn into like a full-time job.
Yeah. I had a small reaction when I heard the podcast. I only heard the first half of it so far. And then I think this also gets into a bigger picture thing that I actually spoke a lot about at this retreat this week. And so I think it's relatable. But when I heard it, I just thought even the question itself was sort of missing a point about. So like the question I think was like, at what level of MRR is it enough? That sort of implies like, at what level are you okay with plateauing the MRR? And I don't know if that's exactly what he meant, but that's how I heard it. And plateauing MRR means you're eventually going to decline, because churn is a reality. Like you're never going to really have 0% churn except in the very early days. And so in that sense, if you're not growing, you're declining. It's not like you can just settle in at 50K MRR and expect to stay there for very long. You know, if you're not adding customers, you're going to lose customers eventually. So there's that, you know, reality of it. But the bigger thing that I've been thinking about, and this is not something that I think is the case for everyone. I've been thinking a lot about this idea of speed. Like, why move so fast to build a company or build a single product? I think that even in this like bootstrapper world, like if you don't have investors, if you're in these circles listening to these sorts of podcasts for many years now, like there's still been this ongoing pressure that we put on ourselves or that we hear from our peers about move as fast as possible, ship minimum viable stuff, focus on only one thing, you know, avoid distractions and other projects and keep your eye on the ball and just grind away, but ship sooner rather than later and all that. And I think that in most cases, that's actually the right advice. So if you have any sort of like angel investors, or if you have some savings that is finite and it's going to run out, or if you're trying to leave a job or escape consulting, then yes, definitely move as fast as possible, or else you won't make it. Like you have a runway and you'll run out of it. I think that I'm in a different situation. And, you know, our friend Ian Landsman wrote about this a few months back. I think he called it like slow mode growth or something like that, where once you have sort of stair-stepped to your second or third product company, you start to have more of this space to play with. And for me, like 2018 and 2019, this is now over 10 years into me being self-employed, I feel like I've finally reached that space where I can step back. I've got all my bills paid. I've got profit coming off of my first company here. And then that's given me a lot of free time to focus on new products. I'm not trying to leave a job or consulting. I don't have investment money. My own self-funding source is coming off of a business that's continuously profitable. It's not declining. So that, to me, as far as I could see, is sustainable. Anything can happen in the market and things can change. But so given that as my current reality, I feel like, you know, like I still fall into the mindset of like, oh, I need to go super fast and stay super, super focused because that's the right mechanics of doing this sort of thing. But there is this different situation where you can eventually find yourself in. And I feel like I'm finally in that. And like Ian, you know, with Userscape is in that same spot. He's launching Thermostat. I believe it's Thermostat.io. And what I mean by that is, yeah, you know, I'm working on Process Kit, but I do have one or two other things. Like I've got Sunrise KPI already built and launched, and it has some customers. I don't really see that much wrong with hammering away at one product for a while, part of a year, and then take a break and work on something else, and then come back to the first one, that TikTok cycle that Jason Fried has talked about. And I think that's actually healthy, both mentally for the people working on it, like me and my teammates, but also healthy for the company because it, you know, we can take things that we learn and pick up from these other products and projects and bring them into the first one. And it also, you know, adds that optionality, like having multiple things in the burner, even if they're sort of up on the shelf, they're little seeds of ideas that could turn into something, or they're experiments or whatever. Hammer away, yes, like grind away and do the things that you need to do. And if that means give it 6 or 8 months at a time of focus, then that's what it needs. I don't have the common factors that would cause there to be an urgency in the growth rate. But getting back to what Justin and John were talking about, I mean, I would definitely still want all of my products to be growing. It's just that I'm sort of okay with that slow growth. You know, it doesn't have to be extremely fast growth.
The tricky thing is that it takes a while to be able to be patient. Now you can be more patient, so can I, but those first 2 years, it feels like a panic.
I quit my job 12 years ago and I only feel this way now.
Like, you know, that's basically what you're eating as an entrepreneur. Those years, that hurts. It's stressful. It's uncertain. It's frustrating. You want to go faster. You don't have patience when you need it. Yeah, I was just talking to my brother this morning. He's 12 years into his business, and he basically told me he's not made more. He has saved more the past 3 years than he has in all the other years combined, because it took reinvestment and reinvestment and reinvestment, and it just takes a while to start compounding. It feels like there's a lot of residue on bootstrappers from the VC attention and the VC norms.
That's what I mean, yeah.
There's a tweet, you know, Gary Tan from Initialized Capital is one of the cool VCs. He's awesome. He's smart. He seems like a nice person, the whole deal. He wrote about what is expected these days of SaaS companies in VC. And the numbers and the growth is so preposterous for us to compare ourselves to that situation. Like you can't get those numbers unless A, you're a 0.1% freak show, or B, you are spending an enormous amount of money to get it. So the normal numbers from 100K to a million in ARR. So call it 100K MRR, 83K MRR, like that million ARR mark. They want to see 25% month over month growth. So if you're at 100K MRR, next month you need to be at 125. Next month you have to be at 155. It's bonkers. If you're at 1 to 10 million ARR, right? Like that's where we are now. Somewhere between 83 and 830K in MRR. They want to see 10% month over month growth. To be able to sustain that without your company just completely falling apart is insane. Like we should not be comparing ourselves to that. You need to be willing to burn so much money to get there. I mean, that's what venture capital is for. It's the fuel to burn to get to that growth rate. But for us in like normal businesses, growing that fast is not only unnecessary, I feel like it would just break everything.
We're all aware of this reality that we all keep harping on, that SaaS products are long, slow ramps. We know that. The expectation is that a SaaS product is supposed to be slow to grow. That's the trade-off between like a SaaS product and a service, or like a productized service, is that you can actually grow a productized service and you can grow that revenue pretty fast compared to a SaaS. And a SaaS goes pretty slow, but it can probably be more valuable in the long run, right? Like that's sort of the trade-off. And so what I've been thinking again with the same concept is like, if we know that a SaaS product is going to be slow anyway, why work as if your SaaS or my SaaS product is going to be the exception to that rule? And there are exceptions that just really hit a market at the right time, right solution, and they grow really fast. But most SaaS products don't. That's just the reality, especially if it's self-funded and bootstrapped. And so, again, like our community, or maybe we put it on ourselves, or I put it on myself, where it's like. If I just keep hammering and grinding on one SaaS product until it reaches that rocket ship level growth, or until I reached a point where it's like, okay, it's a failure, I'm shutting it down, the more likely scenario is that it grows really slowly and it's in this middle ground to give it all like 100% of my time and resources. If the most likely scenario is going to be in this middle ground where it's not rocket ship growth, but it's not highly profitable for a while, it doesn't make sense to invest 100% of my days and resources in a single product. I think there's room to sort of diversify and have these different options and then end up with a small portfolio, you know.
That's one approach. The counter to that is that you need sustained attention over a long period of time to get that compounding growth. But if you have the patience, you don't need to do that.
But even to that point, though, like, again, like a SaaS product, it's not designed to require me to be on it every single day. The growth strategy is not Brian showing up every single day to broadcast a podcast episode or something like that. Like, it's building a product that serves a need that can then grow, that can scale without me. And I'm not saying like it requires no work. It requires a ton of work and time. To put those systems in place, to build the software, to build the marketing engines. But the marketing engine isn't me personally writing blog posts every day. It's putting a team in place to do those blog posts.
Now, would you say that it's fair, or would you agree that if you spent all of your time on one thing, that it would probably grow faster?
Well, I think that I would put all of my time on one thing for a stretch of time. Mm-hmm. And then put all of my time on a different thing for another stretch of time, and then maybe jump back to the first thing, or you know.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't like try to do two things at the same time. That would be near impossible, I think.
Yeah. Different approaches, no wrong way to go. If you take on other people's money, then it's straightforward. You got to spend all your time on that one thing, make it grow as fast as possible. When you don't, you have that option. You get to choose. You can TikTok all you want between features or between companies. And that's the whole point of this thing, is freedom, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the other bit of urgency, like if you don't have the urgency from, you know, maybe this is the wrong word, urgency, but like from investors, or from a job that you're sick of, or from a savings that's running out. If you don't have those things, the other common one is you have an early access list and you need to keep them. You don't want too much time to go by before that list becomes cold. So you want to get a product in their hands and all that. And I guess I understand that, but at least with me, like with Process Kit, that list is already, we're already almost a year into people sitting on that list, and half of them hear about it and most of them like follow the stuff anyway. So, but at the end of the day, it's like once the product hits the market, like the real marketing begins of SEO and new people finding it and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. We'll see.
I agree. All right. What else we got on the docket here?
I thought I would talk real quick about this MailChimp thing. So I'm actually playing with it today. I haven't made the switch to anything yet, but my plan, I think, is to move my email list to MailChimp for the reason that I think their infrastructure and their product are so much more mature than everyone else in the market. even given how many different tools there are in this market, that I still see MailChimp in my experience using it and trying out a lot of others between ConvertKit, Drip, ActiveCampaign, a couple of others that I've tried pretty closely. Like, I just find that the MailChimp product really does feel the most solid. It's not the most advanced. Like, there are definitely features and things that are missing in terms of like automation workflows, but I feel like their infrastructure and their user interface and the lack of bugs all seem really solid. And then I have had really great experiences with their support, really sort of just going above and beyond and being very fast to respond. And I have not seen the same thing with some other companies. But to sort of close the gap on the fact that MailChimp's automations are a little bit behind the other ones, I'm also playing with Zapier, which I've used Zapier for years, but now they have some new features. I think they're only in Zapier's pro plan level. I think they call them paths, which are like if this, then that. No, you can have a Zap, which is usually just linear, like step, 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 step. Now you can have it split off into path A or path B. And that's pretty interesting. And I started building some automations around my email list. Like, one thing that I do is I give my subscribers an option to opt out of hearing about my productized course openings. Not everyone on my list is interested in productized services, so I don't want to like, I want to give them a multiple outs to just not hear about the emails when I'm doing an opening like I'm doing next week. And so I have like a form on my site that where they can like check or uncheck that box. And when they uncheck it, that hits a Zapier Zap that goes into MailChimp and it removes them from that group. Speaking of forms, again, I'm about to launch my new site on briancastle.com. Similar design, but cleaned up a little bit, and now it's all built on a static site generator. I went with Jekyll on this one. For the forms, I am using Static Kit by our friend Derek Reamer. That's been pretty interesting too. You know, he's done a pretty good job on this. It's a very, very simple product, and I think that was his goal with this thing, was just build something simple and get it out there quickly. And I think I'm going to become like a paying customer of it in the next few days, because he did ship the Zapier integration, and it just, you know, works really nicely. There are other form solutions out there, but Derek is a friend, and I also really like how simple he implemented this. It's really, really good. And I don't usually jump on products like this early in their lifespan, but I feel like this one is a good exception to that.
Yeah, I agree. You can trust him. Nice, man. It's good to hear you made your way through all that technical fog and have it up, and it'll get published. Hallelujah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, after I went on that rant last week, I actually made a ton of progress like later that day and on my trip to Martha's Vineyard, because I was sitting on a train and then sitting on a ferry and got some good work done on it then. So
nice. I can't work when I travel. I don't know.
I'm a big fan of I want to take Amtrak more often. I love it. It's like all the benefits of sitting on a plane, but without all the annoyances. So there's like plenty of leg room. You don't have to like wait 2 hours before the thing takes off. It's got Wi-Fi on the train, great views. I was, you know, going along the coast of Connecticut to get out there, and it was pretty nice.
Nice, man. Well, you know, speaking of travel, I may as well just touch on this before I talk about that product example. Every time I get out of the office and rub up against, you know, just the outside world, I don't know if it's a Portland thing that's just more isolated than larger cities, but I get such a jolt of energy and confidence. We get in our own heads in our companies and about our products, and we know all the shortcomings and all the things that are yet to be done and how behind we feel. And then you just walk out into the market and hear other people's perspective on your product and your company, and it's refreshing. So maybe it just came at just the right time, but if it just felt great to just be out and talking about and hearing other people's perspective, I kind of feel like I walked back into the office like, guys, you don't understand. Everyone loves us. we're doing great. It was helpful on the just like overall confidence and comfort and all that. Okay. So I want to go over a lesson that happened internally here. So we've been finding examples of trying to figure out what is happening in our process, that things aren't coming out of the engineering quite the way we want them to. And we start identifying, oh, it's that shaping work that goes earlier on. And so what happened was we released a feature. So we had, it's closer to a bug fix than a feature. Okay, so on our checkout page, on mobile, what was happening was that the cart summary, the portion of the checkout page that tells you like what product and the image of it and the quantity and the coupon discount field and the subtotal and shipping, that cart summary was expanded by default when it should have been collapsed by default. It should be collapsed, and then if the shopper wants to check it before putting in their payment info, then they click on a button and expands. They can see what's in there, and then they can collapse it back up if they want. So it sounds so simple, right? Oops, it's expanded by default. It should be collapsed by default. Please fix. Done. So we worked on it. It got prioritized. It got put into the sprint. You know, 3 weeks later, whatever it is, it's being released. So it gets deployed. And I'm like, yes, this is one of these things that it was a priority for me. I was not okay with it. Being someone that knowing that that's wrong on the checkout page, I think it's hurting conversions. And I want it fixed. So it was a priority for me. So the engineering team was super happy to be like, Jordan, we got it done for you. And what they did was they gave me a link to one of our checkout pages. So I click on it, instantaneous, less than 1 second. It's wrong. Immediate reaction. Okay, clearly wrong. So first I get frustrated. I roll my eyes like, geez, it's been waiting weeks. And like now it's released. It's in production. It's wrong. So because I have my product hat on these days, I'm like, all right, let's figure out what happened. So I go into Jira, where I used to be a stranger. And now I feel very comfortable in Jira. And I go and I look at the ticket and I look at the history of the comments and the contributions and everything that's in there. And then it's just dead obvious why it's wrong. The lack of direction on the ultimate design was missing. So it had all this information and this thing and that thing and this thing, but it didn't have a clear cut. This is how it should look when it's done.
Like there wasn't any like mock-up or wireframe or anything like that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly right. And so it goes into development without that. And now, so two things are wrong.
So you have developers working on the UI.
Making design decisions. Exactly right. So we have two mistakes. The first mistake is that no ticket should go in like that, where it affects the checkout that shoppers interact with and not have very, very specific design.
You have like a couple front-end people on the team, right? Like we design.
We don't have a designer. So we have a design language and style guide, and this is how our buttons look, and this is how our backgrounds look, and this is our main CTA, and we have all that stuff for the admin, then we have stuff for the templates that are the check pages. So we have these guidelines, but we don't have a designer. The truth is, I don't think we need a designer for this situation. We need a designer for when we come up with new things, but for this situation, it's less about that, and we can use our existing assets, but we need clear guidance. Right, so the original mistake is that it's not in the ticket, but there's a second mistake. The fact that the engineer looked at it and said, okay, I'll start work, instead of demanding, you are setting me up for failure by not providing it to me.
I'm making certain assumptions about the UI that I shouldn't be making.
Exactly right. You are forcing me to make assumptions. You're about to make me look bad is really what we want the engineer to say. And so the second mistake is I will not work on this ticket until it's good enough for me. And right now, it's not good enough. So that was our second mistake. And then it goes in and everyone does hard work and it makes you upset. All the work that went into it.
It's tough on so many levels because first of all, there's like the lost time, like they worked on the wrong thing for a little while. But then it's like you have to go to the team and tell them that that's wrong and that's never fun. And,
yes, it's everything along the line. So what happens is we release something weeks ago. That triggers this cascade of work and expectations and people's time and effort. So a merchant reports it. So now they're reporting it to the support person. So a support person's spending time on it. The support person's then taking their time and saying, okay, I'm going to create this Jira ticket. I'm going to make the product function, product team aware of it. So now product people spending time on it. Then it goes into Jira and then it goes into prioritization. And we say, okay, now we're spending time on it from like a leadership, like management point of view on like what gets prioritized. Then it gets prioritized. Then the engineer picks it up. So he's doing work on it on the back end. Then they get it figured out and it goes to the front end and it gets finished up and then it goes into QA. It's like everybody's spending their time on it. And then the worst part, it comes out and it's wrong and we don't get the benefit that we should and no one's happy. And so there's no love that goes back. There's no positive feedback for the engineering team. Like, yay, this is awesome. Now I'm going to go tell our customers and they're going to be happy. It's all bad. It's one thing leads into another, into another, into another, and it results in no love and no positive feedback and no fulfillment and no, it's crazy.
So what do you think is the change that needs to happen? Because we were talking offline. I think I like more of Jordan Gao getting his hands dirty in the product. I like that. I think that makes sense.
I think it makes sense. I think you're right. I'm really enjoying it. It is a challenge. It is a patience challenge because you want to be able to say, yo, guys, just make it look like Shopify. you think it's like that simple.
But I mean, not. I think that you need to be in there more at the beginning and during the, there it is again, the shape up phase,
yes,
right?
Like the exactly right. So we have this funny situation here that our product person is in Japan. She's on vacation for 2 weeks. So I'm not only do I have my product hat on, I'm alone with the product hat on. Uh-oh. And yes, so now at first I was like kind of rolling my eyes, like, Jesus, I have to spend 30 minutes taking screenshots with arrows and red boxes and being really, really clear. But in reality, what it's doing is it is exposing me to the shortcomings of the process. So what I did was, you know, I got over the emotional, God damn it, it's not right. I said, this is a perfect situation. So I created a Slack channel. One of my favorite things is coming up with new DM combinations. It's my favorite thing. So I'm like, me, the QA lead, the front end lead, back end lead, CTO, head of infrastructure, and product person. I'm like, yes, new DM combination, cool. So I wrote out, I went crazy. I wrote out this whole thing. I said, guys, this is a teachable moment for us. Let's look at what happened. First, here's what came out. Second, here's what should have come out. Third, let's think about why. And so I kind of went through all of this logic that I'm talking through right now. And I said, here's the thing. No one is to blame right now. No one gets any blame. No one, there's no upset. There's no mad. There's no fingers. There's nothing. So on this one, no one's to blame. Next time it happens, everyone's to blame. And you will hear my wrath. There's 2 points of failure. If product screws it up, there's still another point of failure that the developer says, not good enough for me. If it goes through both of those and QA and everything, then you deserve to hear it from me.
I mean, you're totally right about the developer not flagging something, but the challenge is that it sometimes those assumptions are – if there's not enough clear direction from the product person or a designer up front, he might not be aware that it could go one way or the other. It's just his understanding of what the issue was. He was like, oh, then it must be a box that's open by default instead of closed or whatever it is. Like it may just be that he didn't even realize that that's something to clarify.
In reality, the reason he didn't think that it was something he needed to clarify is completely on management, completely our fault that we haven't set that as the standard and the expectation. And so he was just doing what he's used to doing. And how is he supposed to know that that's wrong if we have let that go as a norm? This 2 weeks of me being alone in product, I'm kind of looking around like, guys, it is so obvious why we aren't getting the results that we want out of the process. And now I'm like so energized and it is a patience challenge. It is a weird thing to spend 45 minutes on a ticket, but that's what it takes.
That pre-development time, the week or 2 or month, whatever it takes to just do the design and go above and beyond on the visuals and the user experience flows, like even for the simplest thing. My takeaways from what you just went over here are, number one, just there needs to be more visuals to go along with the technical specs on this, even the simplest feature, right? And if that takes an extra day or two to bounce from the product person over to you, or back to the product person before it even gets to a developer, that makes sense. And then I think the other thing is, this is especially where I think you come in, is everyone, including the developers, need to know why a certain detail is so important like to conversions on the checkout page, you know? Like,
right. That gap is missing.
Like give them like the theory of like, look, if this is 100 pixels shorter in height, that gets the customer closer to the buy button. And, you know.
Yes. Right. The fact that the coupon field being seen as soon as the checkout is loaded makes people want to go to Google to look for coupons is not something that you expect a developer to know. That's not their job.
That little conversion tactic I learned a couple of years ago, and every single product now, I always hide the coupon field. And if I do offer coupons, it's like a special URL. It's not
right. You know. Or it's behind a click, or it's behind the summary, or whatever it is. But what it comes down to is a matter of professional discipline and professional courtesy. Like the courtesy is in, I will not set you up for failure. I will provide you with what you need in this ticket so that you succeed, that it comes out the right way. And the professional discipline is, I refuse to work on this ticket until you have given me enough information to make both of us succeed in what we're trying to accomplish. So it's like, I'm very excited about it because I feel very optimistic about the ability to improve, because now that I see it, there's a lot to improve.
Yep. All right. Product designer Jordan Gall. Woo. I like it.
Very exciting.
Good stuff, man. Got anything else?
No, that's it, man. I sent out a tweet. The summer was tough. Summer goes slow. We made the change from self-serve signups to demos. We lost MRR from it. We really put a lot of work in on trying to make things better. And then the past like week or two, it just feels like everything is working all at the same time, and the team and everyone's happy, and the marketing's working, and the support's getting better, and success. It's just like when that happens, it feels so good.
It's the emotional roller coaster of online business. And like, just to wrap it up on like an up and down note, is like this past week while I was in Martha's Vineyard, I got the very first, actually I got two cancellations on Process Kit, the very first churn. So I'm no longer at 0% churn, which is burned. And I've got like some good feedback from both of them and all that. That put me in like a weird mental state for like 24 hours. And then we got a new customer conversion.
Perfect.
So I was like, all right.
Perfect.
I'm back.
Now you're in it, baby. You're in the game.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Good stuff, man. Good podcast. Thanks everybody for listening. Brian, have a great weekend, man.
You too. All right. See ya.